We're so glad that you've joined us for this second episode where we are wanting to share with you some material that I think will help you understand the creation better. This is something that we just really want to do this year, is to help everyone get more out of the Old Testament. And I think understanding the stages of creation and what we can learn from the creation will help with that. And so thanks for joining us. To understand the stages of creation and the creation story in general in Genesis, we have to understand that this is creation being told from a certain point of view, the view of the ancient Israelites. And so they will share it with symbols that they are used to. If we were telling the same story today, we might use different symbols. And I'll kind of point out some of those along the way. But they come from a cultural background of using symbols to teach and of specific symbols. They're not going to use traffic lights as a symbol. They're going to use the things they're familiar with. And they're of a common nature with the cultures around them in using these symbols and in the general notion of the creation. So they're not trying to teach us all the specifics of creation. God could give us a geophysical or astronomical creation story. This is the creation story that he's chosen to give us using these symbols, and there's something we should learn out from it. So we need to start out by thinking of the difference between order and chaos from an ancient perspective. From all ancient cultures in this area, whether it be the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Canaanites, the Israelites, the Hittites, anyone you want to look at, they don't believe in creation coming ex nihilo or out of nothing. They believe that there was material out there. It was just chaotic material. It was unorganized. We might call it dark matter today. I don't know what we would call it, but it was unorganized material, stuff that was out there, but it wasn't organized. In fact, the Egyptian phrase for the pre-creative period is before there were two things, meaning that they had everything was one big primordial soup, you could call it. It was all the same. Nothing was organized to differentiate itself from anything else. Creation began when there were two things. One thing was organized, so it was different from everything else. That's what we call order. In Egyptian, it's ma'at. We'll look at these phrases a couple different times this year, I'm sure. But order or creation comes when something is organized out of that unorganized material that they would call chaos. The way they symbolized this was with water. That doesn't mean they thought that the universe was water. That's the symbol they chose to use, and it's a fantastic symbol. Water has no shape of its own. Water is without form and void, we could call it, and we'll get into those phrases in a moment. But if you put water, I'm not talking on a molecular level. Of course, the H2O has a structure. But the way we experience water, if you put it in a round container, it will be round. If you put it in a rectangular container, it will be rectangular. It doesn't have a shape or a form of its own. It is both life-giving and destructive. Nothing is as necessary besides oxygen as water is for life, and nothing is as destructive. It ruins and destroys in fantastic ways, and it gives life in fantastic ways. It's a great symbol for unorganized material. And then organization comes as we have some force make something out of that unorganized material, as it orders it. In many ancient cultures, that is a god who creates himself. And in some ways, that has to be true for the Israelites as well, but it's not the way they think of it or present it. They start by just saying, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. So it's understood that there is a God and that he will create everything else. Now, I want to look at these phrases as we go along and see what we can get out of this. So look at verse 2. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the water. So think of that. You've got the deep and the waters brought in there. That's that symbolism that we've been talking about, that God will move upon the unorganized material. We might say the dark matter, the chaos, whatever you want to call it. and he will organize it. And what is the first act of organization? He says, let there be light. And there was light. Now, the light is not the sun and the moon. That comes later. The light is his power, his ability, his giving of himself to the cosmos. And as he gives of himself, he is a light-filled being. All light emanates from him. As he gives to himself, then that is the beginning of creation. You have the darkness, that's the unorganized stuff, and light is him. He is the beginning of creation. So he created. Let's in that verse 1, God created the heaven and earth. Let's look at the Hebrew form or word for that. It is bara, all right? And bara means to organize or fashion. It does not mean to create out of nothing. It means to organize or fashion something. So clearly this is creation that's coming out of something else. Now I want to look at the words, the earth was without form and void. Those two words, form and void. In Hebrew, that's tohu vabohu. Vo is and. So tohu and bohu. All right. But what you'll often hear it say, tohu vabohu. The v is and. So what do those words mean? Well, tohu in many ways means uncultivated. There's something there, but it's not cultivated. And bohu in some ways means unpopulated. Although I think without form and void is a good translation of this. It has no form, or in other words, it hasn't been cultivated into something, and it's void. It's not filled with anything. So we'll just refer to this as uncultivated and unpopulated, tohu vabohu. All right, so those are the two problems with creation that is set out here at the beginning of Genesis. He has this uncreated, unorganized, chaotic material that is not formed, it's not cultivated, it's not organized, and it's void, it's not populated, it doesn't have anything in it. Those are the two problems. So days 1 through 3 will solve the tohu or the uncultivated problem, and days 4 through 6 will solve the bohu or the unpopulated problem. And you're going to see that they parallel each other. I'm not the one to come up with these ideas, by the way. Lots of people before me have seen this. The best explanation I heard that I've tried to take and do at least as well on, and hopefully maybe even improve, although probably not able to, but it's from my friend Josh Sears, who you'll see on lots of our roundtable discussions. But he is the one who I've heard articulate this really well, and I've just tried to take that and give it to you. So let's look at these parallel days. As we give order to the chaos of creation, we're going to look at day 1. Day 1, God divides the light from the dark. Day 2, he divides water from water, right? So let's read the phraseology here. There are a lot of interesting things to go through as we do this. So we know, as we already said, that day 1, he gives light, not that is the sun, but that is himself. Day 2, he says, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Now, that's interesting. We would think initially that that's land. That's what divides waters from waters, but that's not what he's talking about here as we keep going. And God made the firmament, the Hebrew word is rakiyung, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. We'd still think of land there, but verse 8, and God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. So this is not land. The firmament, the rakiyung, is heaven. This is describing the watery chaos. The whole cosmos consists of watery chaos, and he creates a created space. It's the heavenly dome. It's a space that is dividing or in between the midst of watery chaos. Above and below, on all sides of it, are unorganized material, but this is space where creation can happen. And so here the waters are not the oceans. The waters are the unorganized material, and the firmament is the created space. All right, so let's keep that in mind. But he divides water from water is one way of saying that. Day 3, he will divide water from land, but we also get a bonus one. He creates plants and divides them. So let's read it. We get, and God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass and herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day. So you've got the water being divided from the land and the plants, and they're divided into different kinds of plants, and they will reproduce themselves. Now, we're not going to get into a discussion here about this, is this evidence for or against evolution or anything along those lines. In our bonus lesson, our in-depth lesson, that's on our Patreon website. You can go to tsar.website for that and become a Patreon member. It's not very much money. You get lots of great material. You support the podcast so we can keep going. It may tell you you're being directed to an unsafe place, but that's not true. It's just taking you to Patreon. In any case, this is a place where I'll go into what is our actual doctrine, not what are thoughts and theories and speculations, but what is our actual doctrine on the length it takes to create the earth, on evolution, and on other things like that, the role of mankind in God's plan and in his creation. We go into all of that in our Patreon lesson. I hope you'll join us there. But for here, we've done 3 days. Now let's move on to the parallel days. We're going to see day 4 parallels day 1. And in there, he creates lights and divides day from night. So this is the sun, the moon, and the stars. So you remember day 1, he divided light from darkness. Day 4, it's parallel day, he creates the lights of the heavens and divides day from night. Day 5, which is parallel with day 2, where he divided water from water. And day 5, he creates and divides fish and fowl. So again, you can see the parallel. These are the things that will, and you remember the water from water is rakiung, or the heaven, which is another word for sky. There's no different word for heaven and sky. Everything above the land is heaven or sky. So you've got water from water and the creation of the sky or the heaven. Here he creates the fish, and he divides them into different kinds of fish. That's for the water. And the fowl, these are in the air, right? Or the heavens. Day 6, which parallels day 3, where he divided water from land and created plants and divided them. In day 6, he will create beasts, and then the bonus material is creating man and dividing man from the beasts. So he divides beasts, and then he divides man from the beasts. So that's day 6. So you can see how these parallel each other, and how one of these, day 1, 2, and 3, is the uncultivated, or the tohu problem, and day 4, 5, and 6 is the unpopulated, or the bohu problem. So let's look at that. What we have is what we have is that God is going to create the spaces in day 1, 2, and 3, and then he puts things on them, such as he populates the heavens and the fish and the fowl and the water and the air, and then the land in the second set of days. So let's look at this. We're going to go through this again, and I'm going to rephrase. All right, day 1, we initially said he divided light from darkness. I'm now going, and this is the tohu, or the wild place. We could call it the wild place. So day 1 changes, dividing light from darkness. I'm going to just change that to saying that God is present and he organizes. That's what he does in day 1. In day 2, which we've said he divides water from water, another way of saying that is he creates a space for organizing, and he creates the sky and the sea. In day 3, where he divided water from land and created plants and divided them, he creates the land for organizing, and then he organized plants. So that's our tohu, or wild place, or uncultivated problem. Now we move to the bohu, the second set of days, the bohu, or no population problem. Day 4, we said he created lights and divided them from day and night. We're going to change that to the heavens being populated. Day 5, where he creates and divides fish and fowl, I'm going to change that to the sky and sea being populated. And day 6, where he created beasts and then man, we're going to say the land is populated and mankind is created, who is in charge of the plants. That's the first specific job mankind is given. And so that parallels the plants being organized. So you can see that there are these parallels. God is present and organizes is parallel with heavens being populated. Space for organizing in sky and sea is parallel with the sky and sea being populated. And the land being organized, and the planets being organized is parallel with the land being populated and mankind being created too. And he is given charge of the plants. So that's all helping us understand how God, his spirit, his light emanating on the face of the deep organizes and takes care of the tohu and bohu problem, or the uncultivated or wild place problem, and the wild and the unpopulated problem, we should say. All right, so I want to do a question for the day, and that is, why should we study the creation? Why in the world would we study the creation account? And I want to just kind of preface, and what should we get out of it is what I hope will come as we figure out why we should study it. And I want to preface this question by asking us, how many creation accounts do we have? And really, you can say that we have four. We have one in Genesis. We have its parallel but inspired expanded version in Moses. We have one in the book of Abraham. And then we have one in the temple. All right, so we have four creation accounts. That's pretty significant. That's quite a bit. And we can ask ourselves, how often is the creation repeated for us? How often will the average person encounter, the average member of the church encounter the creation? Well, let's just say you're reading the scriptures somewhat regularly. You're going to read the creation story at least once a year if you're reading the scriptures fairly regularly. Let's say you're going to the temple once a month. That's 13 times a year you are having the creation story given to you. What other scripture story do you have put in front of you 13 times a year? Do you have the David and Goliath story put in front of you 13 times a year? What about even the Easter story? We probably should. And if we're just going to talk about understanding the atoning sacrifice of Christ, then the Book of Mormon certainly puts that in front of us more than 13 times a year. But typically, you and I don't read the Easter story or the Christmas story 13 times a year. God seems to want us to be studying the creation very regularly. So now we have to ask ourselves why, and we should take this seriously, because this is the year that's specifically designated to really get into this. And I hope you will really get into this. All right. So I'm going to pose some questions for you here, helped by Elder McConkie. But I'm going to ask you to, in your home or in your different class situations or whoever you get together and study with as you do your Come Follow Me reading, I hope you will ask these questions and explore this together. So let's read something from Elder McConkie. He says, "The revealed accounts of creation are designed to accomplish two great purposes. Their general purpose is to enable us to understand the nature of our mortal probation, a probation in which all men are being tried and tested to see if they will do all things whatsoever the Lord their God shall command them. Their specific purpose is to enable us to understand the atoning sacrifice of the Lord Jesus Christ, which infinite and eternal atonement is the very foundation upon which revealed religion rests." That's important. Let's make sure we understand that. And these are the things you should study together. How do you gain more understanding of our mortal probation by studying the creation? And how do you gain a greater understanding of the atoning sacrifice of the Lord Jesus Christ by studying the creation? I'm going to prime the pump just a little bit. And hopefully you're going to explore these a little bit more as you discuss things together with your friends and your family. I'm going to just say that Elder John A. Widso taught us that the creation can help us understand our place in the universe. So please look at how it does that and the effect that would have on you. It can help us reform. He also taught it can help us reform our priorities, and that's worth your exploring as well. Now let's ask how it might help us understand the atoning. I hope you'll look at other things that the creation will do to help you understand your mortal probation. It really can have an impact on that. I want you to look at that in depth. Now, I also want you to study how it can help you understand the atoning sacrifice of Christ. One thing is it helps us understand who Christ is. So please explore that just understand the vastness of the creation and the Creator. It can help us understand there's a plan from the beginning, and it sets up the fall. That's very important, and it helps us understand that the earth must be redeemed. So these are things I hope you will study as you study the creation with your friends and family. This is a really profound opportunity. I hope you'll especially look at the Book of Abraham account. there are some real differences in the Book of Abraham account. Take some time to go through that. Look at who is creating. You've got this council of gods. You understand it best if you look at it after Abraham chapter 3, but which you have already studied, and that teaches you about the noble and great ones. But you have a council of gods creating. It talks about generations. It talks about watching until they are obeyed. Those are all things that are worth your discussing in your families, with your friends, in your church meetings. Talk about those elements of creation and what we gain from the Book of Abraham account. And I think you're going to have a fantastic experience. I hope this has been helpful for you. I know that God created this earth for us, and he did so in a marvelous manner that highlights, in the end, all of this tohu and bohu business highlights that mankind is God's crowning creation and that everything else was created for us by God. It is filled with God's presence. Every element of it is filled with God's presence. Every element of it comes because of God, and it is for our progression. It is for us to return to be with God, having become more like God. That's the key to understanding the creation accounts and what God was trying to explain, and the scriptural authors were trying to explain as they chose the symbols they did to teach us about creation. I hope you'll explore that. I testify that creation is for you from God through his Son, Jesus Christ. I hope with what we've just done that it's clear that there is so much depth and richness in the Old Testament, and that you have the ability to get a lot out of it, and we hope to equip you with the ability to get even more out of it. Towards that end, I discuss with some of my Old Testament scholar friends in a roundtable discussion, how can we get more out of studying the Old Testament, or what are some aids to studying the Old Testament? That's what you can listen to right now as the second part of our second episode this week. Well, hello, and welcome to our Old Testament roundtable. This is Kent Jackson and Josh Sears, both colleagues of mine at BYU. Kent's retired, and Josh is still there. I'm Kerry Muhlstein, and we're trying to help you find answers to some of the common questions about the Old Testament. We're going to start out today by asking the question, what is the Old Testament, and how do we get the Old Testament? How have we received it in the way that it is today? And I think maybe we can just start by saying it's not a simple answer, because we don't just have one kind of book. And we didn't just get it at one time, and we don't have just one author. It's not the Book of Mormon in that way. So what are the different kinds of books that we have in the Old Testament?
Yeah, sometimes I hear people say something like, oh, the Old Testament is a history from the beginning until Jesus. And that's true for part of the books, but then there's a lot of books that aren't history. Or they'll say something like, it's a book of prophecies of the coming of Christ. And you find those in there, but there's a lot of books that's not what they're talking about. So it is complicated. There's a variety of genres that cover many, many centuries with a variety of authors trying to accomplish a variety of things. So it's probably best to start by thinking of it as a library coming from ancient Israel.
Oh, I love that idea. This is a library. It's a collection of different books that got put together. I think one thing that might be worth doing is to, the way we have it is actually broken down into different genres. So when you read the Old Testament the way we have it now, from beginning to end, you're going to get a lot of one kind of writing. And even with that, each book is different. And then you're going to get a different kind. So do you want to explain the Tanakh to us, Kent?
Yeah, the Old Testament begins with historical books. So we have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, right? And those books take us from the creation down through the end of the career of Moses, right?
Yeah, to about to come into the promised land.
Yeah. And so those books constitute what's oftentimes called the Pentateuch,
right?
Five books. But it continues with historical material after that. We have Joshua and Judges, and then the books of Samuel, and then the books of Kings. And those constitute what we could call the primary history of ancient Israel. And those kind of provide the framework for us for plugging in the other books along the way.
Yeah.
For example, the prophetic books take place during the time of 2 Kings, roughly. And so, unlike in the Book of Mormon, where we have prophetic material integrated into the historical narrative, in the Old Testament, we have separate books of prophecy that we can fit, and we can actually fit most of them pretty well inside the books of Kings, the historical narratives.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's that in some ways, that's the, well, in many ways of arranging it, the third category is the writings of the prophets, right? And there's an important distinction to be made there. There's actually in the history of Israel and the cultures around them, a cultural shift where people start to pay more attention to writing. So our earliest prophets, you don't have writings of Joshua. You don't have writings of Elijah or writings of Elisha, or even really writings of Jonah, who is one of the earlier prophets that we have a prophetic book for. You have writings about Jonah. But then you get prophets who start to write. And so we get Amos and Hosea and so on. But the interesting thing is that for the way we have it, the books, at least initially, the prophetic books are arranged by how big they are, not by where they fit historically, right, which is kind of a funny thing. So you have to, if you want to fit them in, you have to know where to fit them in.
And this has a practical effect on how people are going to read this. So for Latter-day Saints who are following the Come Follow Me schedule, we're going to get these historical books starting in January and going through about the beginning of August. Yeah. And that's, it's easier for most people because there's narrative, there's plot, there's characters, and we're good with that. But then in August, we switch to the poetic and wisdom literature that we spend about a month on, Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job's, those. And then in September through the rest of the year, we're on these prophetic books, which, like you said, are often organized by criteria other than chronological order. So we'll go through a bunch of the history that's roughly chronological. We'll break and just do wisdom and poetic things that are just reflecting on life in general and aren't so tied to history. And then we have the prophets where, like we said, they're from the history that we already read earlier in the year, but even they're not in chronological order, so we'll be jumping back and forth on the timeline a bit. So as we move through the Come Follow Me schedule, people just have to be ready that at certain points, we're going to make a big jump and be reading very different genres, and the reading experience will be quite different.
Right, because we're going through the order of the book,
yeah,
not through the chronology of the experiences.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic way to read it. I personally, when I do my classes, we'll read a couple of chapters of 2 Kings, and then we'll do Isaiah, sure, and we'll read a couple of chapters, and then we do Jeremiah, and so on. So that's one way of studying it, is to try and intermix the chronology. If we don't, then I think it's important as we go, and we'll try and do this in this podcast, as we're hitting different prophetic books, we need to remind people, here's what's going on historically during those time periods, because the prophets are interacting with what's going on around them, just as our prophets do today.
And at the same time, there's advantages to doing it in the genre categories we're doing, because by taking all the prophets together, even though you have to jump around the timeline and that's an extra complication, it does mean that we can really focus on, okay, how do prophets talk? How do they interact? What are the symbols they use? And by doing that all together, it can help us track that through those books in a way that you couldn't if you were splitting it up everywhere.
Exactly. And you see themes as well that you wouldn't see if you're chopping it up. So there are advantages and disadvantages to both ways. Let's talk maybe just for a minute about the timing of the books. We don't know when a lot of this was written, actually. So for example, this kind of historical framework that you mentioned, Kent, a lot of people will put Deuteronomy through the end of 2 Kings. Others will put Joshua through the end of 2 Kings. But it seems to be kind of, they're certainly not written by the same person. They don't tell the same story, but it seems to be intended to be received as kind of a running history. But it's got different authors, not necessarily composed at the same time. We don't know exactly when it was, probably different people going back and editing parts later and so on. And we just get it as if it were all one nice, tidy bundle. So I think that's just worth keeping in mind. What else?
I think it's important that we look at the Old Testament in light of the Book of Mormon, because they're very different in important ways. The Book of Mormon is a book. It's not a library. It's a book. And it was started by Mormon and then finished by his son. And then Mormon and Moroni smartly included the small plates material in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, so that's the kind of library part right there.
Yeah, that's the only library part.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what we have is, with Mormon, we have a guiding hand who takes the library and condenses it down to one book. And so we can see a common vision, a common understanding, a common end goal in mind in Mormon's writing throughout his whole part of the book. And it's perfectly compatible with what we get from Nephi and Jacob on the small plates as well. So in the Old Testament, we don't quite have that, but because we don't have the Book of Mormon is very, very autobiographical, right? It talks about itself all the time. We don't have that in the Old Testament, but we do have, in my opinion, we do have a common philosophy, a common guiding principle that goes through all this historical writing. These were the good guys who wrote. These were the guys on our side that compiled the book. So even though they're nameless, they all are part of the same point of view. And the reason this is important is because in the prophetic books and in the historical books, we get evidence that there were other prophets out there who weren't the good guys. So among the enemies of, say, Jeremiah, for example, and even Isaiah, are other prophets who weren't prophets of the Lord who were prophesying wrong stuff. Well, it's the good guys who preserved the book, and I think that's impressive.
Yeah, yeah. There clearly were other people writing and saying other things.
Yeah.
And we don't know what the process was that people went through to end up deciding, well, these are we're going to keep and put together as a collection of sacred writings.
It could have been a Mormon-like person.
Yeah. Or a committee.
Or a committee.
Yeah.
Who decided to compile them together as we have them.
And to one extent, they had the benefit of time to see who turned out to be correct. Jeremiah said Jerusalem be destroyed. His opponent said it won't. Well, yeah. Jeremiah was right. We're gonna keep his stuff.
Yeah. Jeremiah says, this is how you tell if it's a true prophet. If it comes true, then it's then it was a true prophet.
And then even within that, you'll get, so for example, 1st and 2nd Kings were probably initially just one book. And 1st and 2nd Chronicles, initially one book. So let's just talk about Kings and Chronicles. They have some similar points of views and some similar themes. They're put together by, we don't know who, at what point. It may be one person, it may be several people writing it, each one. And they both are showing us God's hand in his dealings with the Israelites and what happens when you follow God and what happens when you don't. But they each have their own way of going about it and some specific themes that Chronicles will hit, that Kings doesn't hit quite as much, and so on. So there are some overarching principles, and yet there's some individual things. And you do get that in the Book of Mormon a little bit, like, okay, well, here's Alma's teachings, and it has its own flavor, right? But
sure.
But I would say that maybe for 1st and 2nd Kings, you could make a comparison that there is someone or some group of people who function kind of like Mormon, but they are not as transparent as Mormon is. Sure. So, but that's not true for all of the book put together. There's not a Mormon that puts all of the Bible together. It's a collection of writings.
We only get it on the receiving end because we don't know the process of putting it together.
Yeah.
Unlike the Book of Mormon, which basically comes with instructions.
Right? Yeah.
Because Mormon and Moroni tell us what it's about and what they're doing.
Yeah. They even give us a title page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it starts out, I, Nephi, just love the authors naming themselves, whereas for these biblical writings, they seem to feel it was important that they not be named and that this remain anonymous.
Right. Yeah. And you even get difficult questions like we refer to the Pentateuch or the Torah, the writings, well, they're often called the writings of Moses. Well, the way we got them, we have them right now, I don't think Moses is the final author. What his authorship is in there and exactly how that works is not completely transparent. I think he's behind this, but we get the redacted form. We get the form basically like in the same way that the Book of Alma is not the author, but you get Alma in there, right? But we get it from Mormon in the end. We get these books from someone who has crafted them together for us.
In fact, we only know of Alma and Abinadi, for example, through the words of Mormon, who lived half a millennium after their time.
Right.
Because we don't have their books.
Yeah. But you did have groups of people. It's clear, again, we'll go to First and Second Kings. It's clear they had a library available to them. And they are drawing from that library. And they often refer to it, well, in the Chronicles of the Kings, which isn't First and Second Chronicles, by the way.
No.
But
and they mention prophetic books that we don't have as well.
Yeah. So they have a library they're drawing from. They've put it together for us. Then someone else takes that and puts it in a larger library. And eventually that ends up in the Bible that we have today.
And here's another thing to consider. I don't know if Moses ever even knew Hebrew.
Yeah.
So we have the Old Testament in Hebrew that postdates the earliest events by hundreds of years. So at some point, if I were Moses and raised in Pharaoh's court and wanted to write a history, I'd dictate it to a scribe in Egyptian, have him translate it for me or something like that.
Yeah.
But we have them in later Hebrew language, which means that somebody has compiled and edited and translated.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's clear some of this is translation. And then you get books like Daniel that are partially in Hebrew, partially in Aramaic, and so on. We do have a couple little glimpses, and I think this is worth noting, of earlier Hebrew, and it's in the form of poems or songs. Mm-hmm. And that's when language usually gets frozen. We don't change poems and songs. So Beowulf still you read in very old English, right? And that's Exodus 15 and Judges 5. And those are clearly much older Hebrew. That may preserve at least maybe Miriam and perhaps Moses. It's hard to know, but that may preserve Hebrew as early as that. And it's if you read it in the Hebrew, it's clearly different than the stuff around it. This is really like sticking a line of Shakespeare in the middle of something today.
Yeah, like if Shakespeare were quoted in the middle of a conference talk, you could tell when the shift happens. Yeah, we could hear it.
Yeah, exactly.
What I do love, though, is that we've got all these different traditions and records that come together into books and then are edited and shaped. And so it becomes, to say it in a negative way, kind of a hodgepodge, except I think that at the end of the day, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yes.
And we could say that that's the hand of the Lord shaping this at a macro level. Speaking of the Book of Mormon again, I love to look at what the Book of Mormon says about the Bible, and in particular, the Old Testament. For example, in Nephi's vision, in 1 Nephi 13, the angel shows him people in the latter days who were carrying the Bible. And the angel asks Nephi, "Do you know the meaning of this book?" And Nephi says, "No, please tell me." And the angel explains, "This book proceedeth out of the mouth of a Jew. And I, Nephi, beheld it, and he said unto me, The book that thou beholdest is a record of the Jews, which contains the covenants of the Lord, which he hath made unto the house of Israel. And it also containeth many of the prophecies of the holy prophets. And it is a record like unto the engravings which are upon the plates of brass, save there are not so many. Nevertheless, they contain the covenants of the Lord, which he hath made unto the house of Israel. Wherefore, they are of great worth unto the Gentiles." And I love this description that when we look at the Bible as it came together, hodgepodge or not, this long process of redaction, that it has some value because if we look at this, that there's covenants and a record of the Lord's interactions with his covenant people, Israel, and these prophecies of what's going to happen. The angel's clearly indicating to Nephi, when you put all this together, there's real value here, both for Jews and for Gentiles.
In fact, if we a lot of people who don't like the Old Testament or who don't believe in the Old Testament get hung up on really the tiniest and least important things, right?
Yeah.
What's big, if you understand the Old Testament, you're going to see that more than anything else, it's exactly what the angel told Nephi. It's a record from, so we've got some prehistory in Genesis. Then in chapter 11 of Genesis, we're introduced to Abraham and his family. From that moment on through the whole rest of the book, it's a story about God making a covenant with people and how to live that covenant and what the consequences are of living the covenant and not living the covenant.
Yes.
If that's all we know from the Old Testament, we're in really good shape.
Yeah.
We're in really good shape. And all of that comes through. So whether or not there's a talking donkey in the book of Numbers or whatever else there is that people get hung up about, that message runs through the whole text.
Beautifully said. It may be worth, and we don't need to spend long on this, but just noting the what we call the Masoretic text, which is the Hebrew version of the Bible that we base our translation into English on. And that was taken care of by a group that specifically, we know from what Josh was reading, if we'd kept reading the account with Nephi, that things happened to the Bible. But at some point, there's a group who gets this collection together, and they take very careful care of it to where they count how many words are in each chapter, what the center word is, and so on. They have all sorts of accounting things to try to make sure that they don't change the text, they don't lose anything. And they'll even have notes. We can tell that this isn't how this originally read, but we're not changing it because we've received it. And that really reminds me of something else in the Book of Mormon, and maybe this is a good thing to end on, but unless we decide we have more we want to say. But 2 Nephi 29, verse 4, I'm just going to start partway through. Yea, what do the Gentiles mean? Do they remember the travails and the labors and the pains of the Jews and their diligence unto me in bringing forth salvation unto the Gentiles? O ye Gentiles, have ye remembered the Jews, mine ancient covenant people? And then he goes on to kind of get after them for not remembering it. But the Lord seems to be saying, this is an important book, and I am grateful for those who have gone through pains to preserve it and give it to you. And I personally am grateful for that as well.
And the people who did so are some of the great heroes of Western civilization and Amen. Some of the greatest minds ever. The Old Testament text was preserved in Hebrew with beautiful accuracy, so that when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, we discovered that since the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are very few differences in the text because they've been so meticulous to preserve it for us. So yeah, they deserve our thanks and our praise for doing so.